Dear God, give us the openness of mind, the courage to look anew and afresh at the important issues of peacemaking and justice seeking. Guide our thoughts here together and especially in our living in a world that so desperately needs the grace and peace you offer. Amen. My name is Glenn Gersmill. The session is Christian Nonviolence. Engaging the powers is an attempt to grasp at least one way in which we're not simply going to look at being nicer in the world in some kind of superficial Hallmark card sense. And I'm going to attempt to touch a little bit on the biblical basis of the notion of nonviolence as a Christian, or even particularly Christian notion. Talk a little bit about nonviolence as opposed to the way it's used commonly in the world. Touch briefly on the Reformation as an important piece that has shaped the Lutheran tradition in this area. An equally brief moment to look at the Nazi period as a kind of a quintessential expression of violence and the ways in which nonviolence touched on that. And then look at particularly the way a couple thinkers, Walter Wink and Donald Shriver, have, I think, for me at least, incredibly enriched my sense of how we can look at violence and nonviolence and Christian nonviolence in the world, with perhaps a look at a couple secular examples of nonviolence as well. Well, let's see how we can do with that agenda or that effort. In terms of the biblical basis of nonviolence as a Christian perspective and definition of action, it's striking how many times in the Bible and in Christ's definition of his ministry and expression of what his ministry meant, how many times he talked about loving one another, loving one's enemies. And while there's a debate about how far in the future the creation of the kingdom of God or how much of an ideal as opposed to something that Christ actually expects us to do is the notion to forgive our enemies, there's no dispute of the centrality, I think, of that those notions to the world or to the Christian ethic. And at the same time, the biblical word shalom really means peace with justice. The importance and the numerous occasions and central occasions in which it is stressed that Christ reached out to the oppressed, to the downtrodden, the rejected, that we are called to serve the needs of the neighbor, especially the vulnerable and the suffering, who frequently are victims of violence, so that there's a way in which that whole piece of both the prophets and the Old Testament commands and Christ's call to us is very connected to peacemaking. And in fact, note that the number of times in which redemption in Christ is expressed in terms like Romans 5:10, for while we were enemies, we were reconciled through the death of his son. Concepts that we might associate with peacemaking are very central to even the individualistic way in which many have come to see salvation. It's interesting to take a secular philosopher like Hannah Arendt, not even a Christian philosopher, she's Jewish, and to find her saying, and I'm quoting from Donald Shriver's really amazing book, An Ethic for Enemies, The discoverer of the role of forgiveness in the realm of human affairs was Jesus of Nazareth. The fact that he made this discovery in a religious context and articulated it in religious language is no reason to take it less seriously in a strictly secular sense. It has been in the nature of the tradition of political thought to be highly selective and to exclude from articulate conceptualization a great variety of authentic political experiences, among which we need not be surprised to find some of an elementary nature. Certain aspects of the teaching of Jesus of Nazareth, which are not primarily related to the Christian religious message, but sprang from experiences in the small and closely knit community of his followers. She goes on to emphasize that it was really quite a discovery for not only for individual ethics, but also for the social world to consider forgiveness as an interesting tool. And one of the insights that Shriver makes, and one of the ways in which his book is, I think, very important, is that his notion that in both the secular and the religious ethical context, the word forgiveness has been almost exclusively reserved to the interpersonal level. And he finds just a tremendous power in expanding that to the communal. I'll just share one more piece of Hannah Arendt's thought. The possible redemption from the predicament of irreversibility, that is, of being unable to undo what one has done, though one did not and could not have known what he was doing, is the faculty of forgiving. And she goes on to talk about another word that's rich in both the Hebrew and the Christian Bibles, the word promise. In the same way, the remedy for unpredictability, for the chaotic uncertainty of the future, is contained in the faculty to make and keep promises. Interesting to find a secular philosopher plumb such depths out of a concept that to my knowledge anyway, haven't really achieved that kind of vividness and strength in some of my own thinking or in my understanding of the Christian experience in the Christian ethic.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, surely.
You want to wait till later?
Go ahead.
Does he define forgiveness?
Yeah, and in fact, I will. Okay. I'll give you his four-part definition in a few moments. Make sure I do. our time provides, I think, a particularly important context to re-examine and reconsider the value of Christian nonviolence as being a really central part of the Christian life for several reasons. One is certainly there have been models recently of nonviolent changes in government in the Philippines, Eastern Europe, South Africa, that were the results of nonviolent struggle as well, not simply that they just didn't happen without any violence. And also, I've personally experienced a whole new possibility opened up for us in the concern about violence in our communities, concern for about youth violence, that people are interested in hearing about nonviolence in secular and religious contexts in a way that just simply didn't exist 5 and 10 years ago, or perhaps I didn't know how to tap or make them exist. But it's just indisputable to me that there are groups. I mean, you know, PTAs are asking me to come and talk about nonviolence in a way that just simply didn't happen before. Well, let's do just a little bit of a look at the word nonviolence and some of the difficulties that it presents, and some of the reasons why they don't often call me up and ask me to talk about nonviolence. They won't use that word, but they'll say exactly what it means. And that is the problem that the word nonviolence has come in the popular view to mean simply the absence of violence. In fact, it would be really good if we could get the editorial writers and newsmakers and media people to use a different term for that. When they really mean not violence, to say that rather than using the word nonviolence, and reserve the word nonviolence for what we will be talking about in this session. And if a narrower part of the concept of nonviolence is pacifism, what we mean here is pacifism with two S's. That's the kind of popular culture vision of what we're talking about here. And it's instructive to look at the word that Gandhi used. Satyagraha, the two roots of the word, mean truth and force, neither of which is contained in the kind of colloquial street version of the word nonviolence, where you're meaning something cowardly frequently, or the person who runs from conflict, when in fact nonviolence is precisely, as Wing calls, the third way. It is neither flight nor fight. It is truth force. It is active in its expression. If it means anything, Gandhi never tired of telling people, if it's a choice between cowardice and picking up a weapon, find the weapon. He was as committed and as convinced that nonviolence was the way as anyone who's ever lived, I think. And yet, he saw it as something that required a power. He saw it as something that was active and effective in the world. Again, in contrast to the stereotype that you often see. There are the people that are patriotic, and then there are those pacifists who really want to sell our country's soul down the river, who are too cowardly and unmanly to do the right thing. And in fact, there's a double standard that has resulted from the lack of a word in our culture that means nonviolence or satyagraha. There becomes this double standard where if 30 people are killed and a few others injured in a peacekeeping mission, there's a call to pull our troops out, as happened in Somalia. Now, there were mistakes were made there, but you know, for 50,000 people to die in Korea, and for at least by the time 30,000 people had been killed in Vietnam, there still was not a majority of the public that had decided that violence was ineffective. It takes 100 times fewer casualties in a nonviolent struggle to get people to say nonviolence doesn't work. Well, let's take a kind of a pit stop here, or a stop along the way, and just take a moment to look at the Reformation, and particularly Luther, as in part because of his impact and you know the centrality of his thought on our tradition. It's interesting to note that while people are mostly familiar with his opposition to the Peasants' Rebellion, his emphasis on order, that in fact he was very, very intent on safeguarding the importance of nonviolence in Christian ethics. Like Augustine, for example, Lisa Sol Cale emphasizes that he would give up the Christian individual's right to self-defense even while maintaining it for a state. Or a little later in the book, she quotes Luther saying, Jesus tells his followers, quote, you have the kingdom of heaven, therefore a Christian will not, and this is a quote from Luther, seek legal redress in the law courts, nor refuse to suffer every evil and injustice without avenging himself. I mean, there really is a Christian ethic of nonviolence in Luther, to many people's amazement. Luther insists, again, a quote, that the Christian's way is altogether different for what we have been transferred to another and a higher existence, a divine and eternal kingdom where only mutual love and service should prevail, even toward people who hate us. Now that was is modified by or weakened, I suppose you could say, by some of the problems with the Two Kingdoms doctrine, but also simply he lived in a world in which the political structures were just vastly different than they are today. I mean, if he had lived today, I'm convinced that we would find some things that would be more useful for our experience today. But I mean only to emphasize that in addition to the parts of the Lutheran tradition that would support a just war kind of perspective, there's plenty that can undergird a nonviolent perspective. Well, let's take a look at a place where Lutherans were inextricably and tragically interwoven with a conflict situation and the ways in which some of the heroes of Lutheranism, Bonhoeffer and others, dealt with that. I'll start with some secular resistances to the Nazi situation. The Nazis are Hitler is one of the most frequently called upon figures in history as an absolute demonstration that nonviolence couldn't possibly be the basis of an ethic. What would you do about Hitler is perhaps the leading question thrown at someone who believes in a nonviolent perspective. And Walter Wink gives us a whole new view of it, or at least different from the secular, the popular view. He maintains nonviolence did work whenever it was tried against the Nazis. Bishop Cairo told Nazi authorities that if they attempted to deport Bulgarian Jews to concentration camps, he himself would lead a campaign of civil disobedience and lie down on the railroad tracks in front of the trains. Thousands of Bulgarian Jews and non-Jews resisted all collaboration with Nazi decrees. Bulgarian clergy and laity hid Jews. Christian ministers accepted large number of Jewish converts, quote-unquote, making it clear that this was simply a trick to escape the Nazis. They would not consider the vows binding. Because of these and other non-military measures, all of Bulgaria's Jewish citizens were saved from the Nazi death camps. Romania at first persecuted the Jews, then reversed itself, refused to surrender a single Romanian Jew living within the state's traditional borders to the death camps. Finland saved all but six of its Jewish citizens from death camps through non-military means. Of 7,000 Danish Jews, 6,500 escaped to Sweden, aided by virtually the whole population and tips from within the German occupation force itself. Denmark's resistance was so effective, Adolf Eichmann had to admit that, quote, the action against the Jews of Denmark has been a failure. Norway, the underground, helped spirited 900 Jews to safety in Sweden. Another 756 were killed, all but 20 in Nazi death camps. Holland, etc. I mean, the historical record is actually the opposite of what we're taught. That, in fact, the violent resistance were significantly less successful than the nonviolent resistance to Hitler. The tragedy is, Wink concludes, not that violence did not work against the Nazis, but that it was so seldom utilized. The Jews themselves did not use it, but continued to rely in the main on the passive non-resistance that had carried them through so many pogroms of the past. He's making it clear he's not blaming them. And the churches as a whole were too docile or anti-Semitic and too ignorant of the non-violent message of the gospel to act effectively to resist the Nazis or act in solidarity with the Jews. And in interrogation of Nazi generals after World War II, these generals asserted they expressed complete inability to cope with nonviolence as practiced in Denmark, Holland, Norway, and to a lesser extent, France and Belgium. They were experts in violence, but they were baffled by other forms of resistance. Or look at the record of Hitler. His fear of the power of the churches far exceeded the actual effectiveness that churches were able to bring to bear on the questions that concerned them. So it's interesting that we even take an argument that is frequently the cornerstone or the leading argument of those that assert that you really, violence is nice. I mean, it's good. I wished I could believe more in it, but it's just not practical. Turns out, in even the strongest single historical illustration to be not true. And in fact, one can call upon the historical evidence in support of nonviolence in a very practical kind of a way. And one of the tragedies of history is, while if you ask the person on the street, you know, what comes to mind when you think of the notion of religious violence or religious motivated violence, I'll bet 95% of the responses would be a fanatical Islamic fundamentalist willing to rush the machine guns, you know, because he believes that he's going to go to heaven if he sacrifices his life in for the sake of jihad. Okay, is that about right? The actual historical record, of course, is that many, many more people have been killed and have killed under the banner of the cross than all other banners put together. Or, to take it a step further, if you look at the number of millions of people killed in all sorts of wars, in the 1500s, under 2 million, 1600, 6, 1700, 7, 1800s, 19, what would you suppose is the total for the 20th century so far?
People killed
in by violence in military kinds of military activities. That's pretty close. I believe it's 107.8. Over 100 million people. And of course the majority in wars in which one or both sides claimed they were fighting as Christians. A Mennonite group has a poster that just came out a little while ago, and it says, "A modest proposal for peace, that Christians would not kill Christians, would agree to stop killing in the name of Christianity."
Maybe we don't have to worry about pollution, huh? We'll just kill ourselves.
Right. I guess another kind of piece of the statistical puzzle, whereas from in modern war, 1700 to 1900, the percentage of civilians who are killed, you know, one of the principal theses of the just war tradition is the protection of non-combatants, virtually none, 0%. World War I, it was up to 20% or so. World War II, perhaps half of all the people who died. In the post-war period, the statistic looks at the 80s, it's around 70%, and wars today, more often than not, it's 90% of the casualties are civilians. We have weapons, both nuclear, but also biological, chemical, conventional, that are very indiscriminate, very difficult to even identify, you know, military targets versus others. And Walter Wink and others raise these kinds of figures to ask, you know, are we seriously, on the basis of these kinds of numbers, going to go into the 21st century still defending just war thinking? I mean, there are really a fair number of ethicists who are questioning whether just war thinking, if it ever was appropriate, can it be applied to modern war, given how indiscriminate it is in actuality? Which is the leading alternative to a nonviolent perspective in public kinds of affairs. It's enough of a separate debate that I'll leave it to discussion if people are interested in pursuing it further. And instead, move on to my promise to take a look at forgiveness in politics. Donald Shriver gives a four-part formal definition of forgiveness. He says, first of all, forgiveness begins with memory suffused with moral judgment. Popular use of the word forgiveness sometimes implies that to forgive is to forget, to abandon primary concern for the crimes of an enemy. Quite the reverse. Remember and forget would be a more accurate slogan to Shriver. He goes on in that section to make a very, very sophisticated point. Logically, forgiveness goes from the wrong sufferer to the wrongdoer. But in human societies, and most of all in political contact, it may have to go both ways. And similarly, it may be the wrong sufferer that has to take the first step. It's not waiting. It's not a matter of waiting until the wrongdoer makes up his mind that something is wrong. His second point, that while forgiveness in politics, as in other human relations, does not require the abandonment of all versions of punishment of evildoers, it does require the abandonment of vengeance. And this is its second constituent element. And he uses the word forbearance and gives it a kind of a new life. The forbearance element in forgiveness is likely to surprise former enemies. Do unto others what they have done unto you seems to be the ordinary rule of give and take in human associations. Equally surprising may be the third element in the transaction that has great significance for the construction of new political relationships: empathy for the enemy's humanity. He distinguishes it from sympathy, gives some examples of it. And I'll wrap up with the fourth dimension. Genuine forgiveness aims at the renewal of a human relationship, not merely an isolated act of moral high-mindedness. Forgiveness aggressively seeks to repair the fractures of enmity. So the four points are memory suffused with moral judgment, abandonment of vengeance, empathy for the enemy's humanity, and aggressive seeking to repair the fractures of enmity. And that, in fact, that language and that conceptualization could be enormously useful in our world today. It may be the missing piece in healing the problems that we face in the world. That there are just too many conflicts where, again, I'll take Bosnia or the Middle East, the popular descriptions of those conflicts by news writers and editorial writers, op-ed writers, are just replete with centuries-old conflict. You know, you really can't expect. I mean, they've been in each other's throats for years, blah, blah, blah. And it simply isn't true in any of those cases that should be enough to allow ourselves to wash our hands of it. Just take Bosnia. I mean, you talk to almost anyone who's lived there or traveled there. They would say most Bosnians have lived alongside of, intermarried with, and worked alongside of all of the other ethnic groups. That Bosnian state that has been reduced to a few isolated pockets like Sarajevo and Bihac, and then this, you know, scrunched-in, grayed-in area, is a multicultural state, including all of those different ethnic groups. There are Serbs in Serbia, but there are Serbs in Bosnia, and there's trust there yet. There isn't a sense that that's going to be a fifth column that's going to undermine them. To come to the point where I've developed a kind of a law of reading the newspaper, if there's something that makes you feel like this, that makes you feel paralysis, be suspicious. Suspect that someone is being careless with the truth, or is not doing their job as someone in the media.
Can that type of forgiveness work without it emanating from the heart? I mean, can the motivation be simply one to say it's a logical approach to cut down the slaughter of people?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it helps that there is some kind of human tenderness or whatever, but self-interest, you know, can be a motivator there too. I mean, I think both. I think of some of the amazing things that Bishop Tutu did to reach out to the humanity of de Klerk and other leaders in South Africa, for example. Just really, it brings tears to my eyes even to think about him. I mean, just the incredible capacity that he had to remain human and to appeal to the humanity of the opponent. But it isn't necessary for that to be the only appeal. There's plenty of self-interest. And one thing that nonviolence does is by not calling forth a violent response as strongly as violence would, it makes it possible or more possible for both sides to retain that sense of humanity of the other and to, you know, when there is accommodation that looks like it may be necessary, it becomes easier. And when you have accommodation, when you begin to live alongside of each other, when there's trade that goes back and forth, it becomes then possible for higher levels of human connectiveness, you know, to take place, friendships and further kinds of activity.
That unfortunately, the picture we always get is that there is a certain core of people that have lost their sense of humanity, and you can't deal with them.
Yeah, and I have another campaign. I would love it if people would try, as a difficult experiment, to forgive 7 times.
Yeah.
We are so far from the world that Christ lived in that to try forgiving even our co-workers 7 times before we gave up on them would be a great advance, in my opinion. Let alone what Christ, you know, commanded us to do, right?
For the same sin, too.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah. Start the count over from 1 when it's a different sin. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm stunned by how in educational institutions I've worked in churches, in congregations, and so forth, people will come to a judgment about someone else and basically build a wall that isn't insurmountable, but by and large becomes a barrier to them working effectively together because they decided that person can't do such and such, or that person will always do this, or that person is, you know, can't be relied on in this way. And let those prejudices, those judgments, those limits stop before they've forgiven them even 1 or 2 or 3 times, let alone 7, let alone 70 times 7. I guess I want to share one more vision or one more inspiration before sort of opening things up a little bit. And that is one of the most amazing stories on the planet, the story of Badshah Khan. If you were to ask specialists or people that have traveled or as a hobby read widely about the history of conflict and violent peoples and ask the question, what are the 2 or 3 most violent peoples in the history of the world? Most people would have high on their list, if not at the top, the peoples that inhabited the area of the Khyber Pass and the area between what is now in Pakistan and Afghanistan, the Pathans. And during the time when Gandhi was alive, one of the leaders of the Pathans, Badshah Khan, heard about Gandhi and paid him a visit. Why? Not because he had any interest in nonviolence, because he had heard that Gandhi understood the nature of power. And as someone from a tradition that, with an intense warrior, masculine kind of spirit, he was very interested in power. Well, he came, he heard, he stayed, and he became a convert of nonviolence, went back to his peoples, passed on the ideas and organized a nonviolent army. A nonviolent army that would interpose itself in regions of conflict with, for hundreds of miles around without weapons. A nonviolent army not of a few dozen people or a few hundred people, but in several cases, tens of thousands of his followers would do this. If this most violent tribe or nation or ethnic group, more appropriately, in history could find this and could understand that nonviolence is more than simply passivism or not violence, but that it actually is a superior conception of the relationships of power, a superior understanding of dealing with conflict than violence, you know, maybe there's hope. And in fact, maybe stories like that could be useful in us reaching more than simply the people that can respond to the appeal of the Hallmark card version of nonviolence that all too often has dominated our cultural discourse about the notion of nonviolence. Or I cite Gene Sharp, who takes a very non-philosophical approach to nonviolence. That is, he may or may not be interested in nonviolence as a kind of a personal ethic. He's talking about it purely or particularly as an understanding of power. This is the first of a three-volume a phenomenal work on the subject. And it's interesting because the person who wrote the introduction was arguably the most brilliant figure in post-World War II United States strategic thinking about conflict, Thomas Schelling. And it's really, I studied with him in graduate school, and he's like this monumental figure in the whole history of using game theory and other very sophisticated techniques to think about U.S.-Soviet strategy and tactics and deterrence. You know, the heart of the militaristic, you know, Cold War thinking. That figure finds himself writing the introduction to probably the most comprehensive survey of nonviolence as a tactic and a strategy ever written. And it's kind of an amazing world we live in. And I think there's a lot of really exciting new works in the Christian tradition as well as in the secular tradition, but perhaps especially in the Christian tradition from South Africa. This volume of essays between Christ and Caesar. People that have been doing it for a long time and wrote really many books, John Howard Yoder and Thomas Merton, Stanley Hauerwas, similarly, as well as new writers like John Deere or the Douglases. Roland Baton, again, one of the older figures. There's really a wealth of wonderful resources in the area. And with that, let me stop and let's take any questions or examples or issues that can advance our thinking or correct it or help us address this point.
Do you think there's more violence occurring with kids now than there has been in the past?
Very good question, because in some statistical measures and in some areas there's maybe a slight increase, but what is really decisively different is the escalation from fists to knives to guns.
The weapons of violence.
The use of handguns and other firearms has just skyrocketed, so that there, you know, I can't remember the figures right offhand, but you know, I could get them pretty quickly. The cause, you take a population of somewhere in the range of like 15 to 30, the leading cause of death is violence. Not accidents, not AIDS, not other kind of sicknesses, not all of those put together in some, you know, definitions. So, yeah.
What is your theory behind that? Do you have any thought about that?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot. Actually, I'll give a short answer, and I'd be happy to hear other people's response to that. Certainly two important pieces are the wide availability of guns The statistical comparison of firearm deaths in the United States versus other countries is just incredibly eye-opening. And then secondly, the ubiquity of the most violent kinds of responses to conflict in the media. It's just saturation level. You know, the average child graduates from high school having spent more hours in front of a TV set than in the classroom, and having seen 100,000 violent murders and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of violent responses to conflicts. Be very instructive to get a classroom of kids with a tally sheet and categorize the different ways in which violent situations are addressed in all of the media they watch in a week, let's say. And I'll bet 95% are resolved violently, and you know, or 85% violently, 10% in a kind of a mixed way, and 5% in any kind of a productive, functional sort of.
I was going to say the violent way of responding can also be verbal violence.
Right.
You know,
right.
That I think is taught to everybody on TV as being okay.
Right.
Yeah, I think an example, a show that my mother loves is Roseanne, and it's so negative and verbally abusive but it's teaching people that this kind of talk is all right.
Right. Although I would have to say that I'm a kind of, I have several friends who are trying to re-educate me about Roseanne. There's something about working class and women, or both in her case, her character, just like putting it out there, that is both refreshing, but it's also, I think, has a productive or positive side. Now, my total number of hours of viewing of Roseanne can be counted on less than a hand, so I'm really citing my friends rather than myself on that, but that's a sidelight. But
we can laugh at it and realize that it's not okay, that's all right, but
yeah.
I think what's happening is that people are learning that this is a strategy for talking rather than learning not to do that.
Right.
Like Archie Bunker type stuff.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Two questions. One is related to what you just said about television and the media in violence. I'm wondering as to how much that has really changed. I'm trying to think as to what kind of entertainment I grew up with, and it was the Lone Ranger and all of those, you know, the good guys shot the bad guys, and it was all over and done with. I mean, we did not have any models for negotiating,
or right.
We had no nonviolent models,
right.
And yet somehow the other. We'd like to think most of us grew up, you know, basically nonviolent. So that's
right.
Question one. The second question is just how do you define violence so that we understand what nonviolence is?
Right.
And what place does power, control, words, loud words, size,
right.
All of that kind of thing that play into violence that may not be necessarily very physical?
Right. I really ought to have a definition at my fingertips. I'll cop out by saying I can accept the kind of common definition of bodily injury, and then a moving toward the gray area of very aggressive, offensive, you know, invasive words or actions, and then a gray area of strong speech. And then more of the negotiating and so forth stance. So I use it in a pretty much the kind of street language of that. I think I owe it to myself and you to get a better handle on those, on that term. But just that I've seen them, but I'm not prepared to do more than that here. In terms of the media. First of all, I really want to recommend Wink's book. If you do nothing more than stand up in the bookstore here or somewhere else and read the first chapter, he talks about the myth of redemptive violence in American culture. And in fact, about half of the first 25 pages are a really illuminating discourse on violence in the media. And the myth of redemptive violence, or the, you know, the level of violence in entertainment in the United States since movies, you know, and in fact their predecessor, Richard Slotnick's Gunfighter Nation, the third volume of his astonishing trilogy on violence in our culture, I would recommend, traces the roots of violence in Westerns, in movies, and then in television, in really an illuminating way. So there's certainly violence in the media all the way through its existence in our culture in the last half century. Having said that, however, and having said that, and having made the observation that there's a lot in violence in our culture now that's indistinguishable from when we were growing up. You compare Bugs Bunny and the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and they're two different levels of violence. In terms of the amount of it, in terms of the technology, the use of weapons and so forth, not simply beating people over the head and having people flattened by safes and so forth that we saw as kids, but and then bounced back, of course. But in terms of dismemberment and death of the opponent, and in terms of the violence of it and the gore of it and the number of occasions of it, and also the lack of any kind of sense of morality. I mean, there's a kind of a outsider, it doesn't even have to be a hero that does it. It's, the characters themselves are much more repugnant. I mean, there's a tremendous escalation. I mean, children's television has really, it's just unbelievable what has happened to children's television. I mean, if there's an argument, and there are quite a few, for us to rethink giving free use of what ought to be a public utility, the airwaves, to whoever has the bucks to buy children's television ought to be one of them. I mean, it's just unbelievable that we let that happen.
I was at a workshop. I'm an educator in the school district, and I spent an all-day workshop looking at the impact of TV on children. And the statistic of a study that was done in which they took television programming and watched over time is that adult television viewing is filled with about 6% of the viewing time is filled with violent action. Children's television is over 35% of children's viewing time is filled with violent action. And it was kind of talking about the contrast of the impact of that amount of violence on a very young child who does not have an adult in their life to debrief with them, to talk with them about what they're seeing, to present the this is just television or this is not the way we would act in real life. But we have children watching innumerable amount of TV during the daytime, and there is no adult interaction to talk with them and to help them debrief that. And that is the insidious nature of the dilemma that we're experiencing. We can gear children to good TV viewing. We can have them view TV and debrief with them or sit with them and talk about why this isn't good. But that's the piece that would kind of be the nonviolent part that we as parents or as adults, grandparents, whoever we are, adults in the lives of children, need to be really conscious of that for our children, particularly the children under age 8. They're really in danger in this nation. It impacts their learning in the classroom, but lack of attention. Right. It gets really multifaceted.
See, and I played as a child, too. I played cops and robbers, but I can't remember ever wanting to hurt anybody doing that. And I think that's what's changed today. Because you see the blood, you see,
right,
those kinds of things, and kids are, that's what scares me.
Right. And, to be fair, I think it's important for us to understand the role of play among children. I mean, it is the place for children to try on adult roles, the adult roles they see around them. And I would not advocate, clamping down on children's play. In fact, the reverse. You want to have a hand in it, but you also want to have stepped back enough to watch it, to be able to learn from your children by how they're playing, and not attempt to channel it too severely. And in fact, I think, I mean, we weren't allowed guns. We didn't have television until we were in junior high. And yet we played with guns every chance we could get. And I think the reason is in part one of the great unspoken gender realities in our culture is that one of the hurts that is visited on male children is to be told by their culture in their upbringing that you need, as a male, to be prepared not only to risk death as a soldier, but to kill. And children, I think, instinctively know this is kind of wild stuff, hard stuff, and try it out. I mean, they're enacting it out as a way of trying to grapple with it and as a way of trying to get a sense about it. I believe that sexism is one of the terrible things in our world. Part of gender hurt in our culture is visited on men as well. There's a big difference. It's not visited on men by women. You know, women are not the vehicles of this kind of sexism or this kind of gender hurt. But I mention it because I was once at a conference where this point was raised, and the women in the audience, men and women had studied gender issues separately and then came together, and the woman leader asked the women in the audience, what would it take for you to imagine that you could be prepared to kill someone as a part of your role in life? And the list they made was the lists of hurts that young boys have to experience, and the list of hurts that hobble them, that limit them, that make them less functional as husbands and fathers and citizens. Suppressing of your feelings so that you can, you know, like go out and do something that's stupid, you know, that's terrible, for example.
Getting back to the forgiveness, you were talking about the Northwest had done a bishop's apology, which the major denominations apologized to the Native American community for churches had done to Native American community in their process of gaining control of the Pacific Northwest. The growth of that apology was similar to those four steps that he was mentioning. That the Lummi tribe nation had been the instigator of the apology, and the bishops took it upon themselves to do that apology. And then we as Indian people, in accepting that forgiveness and then working at walking side by side within the different denominations that are ones that helped write that, sign that apology, that we are working side by side within the Christian community. And the other thing I would have brought up would be the Columbus Quincentennial that I had worked on for 2 years. Within the ELCA, we wrote a document as a response for the 500th year for Columbus coming to America. And that we in our, not only as a Native American people, but also a Native American Lutheran people, were able to work on responding to the Columbus Quincentennial so that we could work on growing into both a forgiveness and a regrowth with us as a community.
I really appreciate that. Because it's these kind of case studies that I think shed a lot of light on the kind of abstractions that has been part of what we've done here. And Shriver has full chapters on Japan, like Pearl Harbor, Hiroshima, Japanese-American experience in the United States, another on Germany in the United States, another on the Civil Rights Movement, where he'll go in depth into, you know, all of the different issues and the ways in which we've come to terms with or not the conflicts that are illustrated there.
Are there workbooks for kids on developing forgiveness?
Probably. I mean, I'm not the best person to ask. I ought to be. And in fact, I would really love to hear. I'm working on a curriculum project that it's in its third year now where we're dealing with this. And I guess my mind has been opened up just literally in the last few months. This came out in March or April or something, and this one is I've just finally picked up. It came out the end of last year, so this is really a new bit of thinking for me. I would really appreciate hearing about answers to that question. I'm more familiar with the secular literature, like Getting to Yes, for example. Or John Howard Yoder's What Would You Do? Takes the classic case studies of like someone comes to the door and they're armed, what would you want to do about it? And in fact, there's a wonderful anecdote of William Jennings Bryan, a very political figure from the United States, visiting Leo Tolstoy, who was a pacifist. Bryan asked him the typical test question, what should one do if a criminal is about to kill a child? Tolstoy, who recorded the conversation, replied that in all of his 75 years, he had never encountered that fantastic brigand who before my eyes desired to kill or violate a child, but that perpetually I did and do see not one but millions of brigands using violence toward children and women and men and old people and all the laborers in the name of the recognized right of violence over one's fellows. When I said this, my kind interlocutor, with his naturally quick perception, not giving me time to finish, laughed and recognized that my argument was satisfactory. Wink also quotes that anecdote in greater detail. The New England Journal of Medicine, reports, that gun in the drawer in the hallway that is going to protect you against the invader, or underneath your pillow or bed spring, is 43 times more likely to be used against a cousin, friend, family member, neighbor's child, or neighbor's child on your child, than against any kind of intruder. The FBI's own statistics show that less than 0.5% of all use of firearms are even in remotely self-defense kind of situation. And it's important, because I'll do polls in just average PTA groups, and half the hands will go up that they would feel safer if they had that gun in the drawer of the hallway bureau. We've got a lot of work to do. And in fact, I would like to inject here my passionately held belief that, as I said earlier, we have an opportunity in the current situation, both internationally and with the concern of community violence, to convey a different vision of dealing with conflict than before. And I invite you to both join that, but also to continue the conversation, as many of you are already involved in learning about the way in which nonviolence can be a useful tool for resolving conflicts. Books like Getting to Yes, that I mentioned earlier, are really great. I mean, they're just really eye-opening on this score. Secondly, and kind of in tandem with that opportunity, my reading of Barman and Bonhoeffer and the German Christian response, the Confessing Church's response to Nazi Germany, has been really a valuable and an important experience for me in posing for us the question, what do we do as community, as Holden community, as Lutheran Peace Fellowship community, as Lutherans, in dealing with these kinds of issues? And I am persuaded that one of the principal lessons of the Confessing Church of Nazi Germany is the importance of us understanding that our life is not limited to the interpersonal realm. We are inescapably citizens. We are inescapably members of a larger community to whom we have a God-given responsibility. We are called to be peacemakers in that.